Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane. When we think of the bohemian lifestyle, images of Greenwich Village or Paris maybe come to mind. But 150 years ago, a small smoky saloon in New York City found itself the epicenter of a fledgling bohemian movement in America. Pfaff's ended up something of a historical footnote, but it was home to an artistic circle who included Walt Whitman, Ada Clare, Artemus Ward, and Ralph Waldo Emerson. This hour, we explore Pfaff's and its largely unknown influence on American culture. Justin Martin is author of Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman and America's First Bohemians. Justin Martin, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
So to start us off, I'd like you to read a passage from your book, if you will, to kind of set the scene at Pfaff's.
I'd be glad to. Sawdust covered the floors. A handful of wooden tables and chairs were scattered about. Above the conversational din, one could hear the distant clatter and neighs from horse-drawn coaches on Broadway. The low ceiling hung thick with smoke. A small number of gas lights provided the sole illumination, faint and flickering. The play of shadows was extreme, contorting the saloon's customers so that they looked by turns grotesquely squat or wildly elongated. All of these elements contributed to a kind of spectral, otherworldly feeling.
And that was Pfaff's Saloon. So who might we find there if we were to walk through the doors in 1852, say?
If you walk through the doors, it had two separate rooms. In the larger room, you just find all kinds of all stripes and manner of societal outliers, people who are just sort of rebels and didn't fit into society. Then in the smaller vaulted room, you'd have found a long table, and this was a kind of a rigorously curated group of bohemians separate from that main room of the saloon. And along that table, you'd find Henry Clapp, the man really who's responsible for importing the concept of bohemianism from Paris. And then along that table, on any given night, you'd probably have found the poet Walt Whitman. You'd also have found such figures as Artemus Ward, who's really rightly credited as America's first stand-up comic, Ada Isaacs Minkin, who became known for her body act known as the Naked Lady Act, and a variety of other people. There are 30 spots along the table. There are many regulars. There are also people who made an appearance periodically, and it was quite a vibrant scene.
So I imagine that there were many other establishments which looked like Pfaff's in New York City, but what was the draw for Pfaff's?
The draw of Pfaff's was severalfold. It was its location. It was at the intersection of Broadway and Bleecker Street. And so this was in a time when Broadway in Manhattan was a great source of entertainment. This was long before radio, very long before the internet. And the way people spent their evenings often was ambling along Broadway. And they'd find all kinds of things there. They'd find shops that are interesting to them, freak shows. You kind of sort and classify yourself as you made your way along Broadway. And a certain kind of person was drawn to Pfaff's Saloon, people who were sort of, as I said, outliers, rebels, bohemians. And so the address certainly played a role. And the other thing that really made Pfaff's a welcoming atmosphere was a proprietor, a man named Charles Ignatius Pfaff. He really styled his bar as a kind of European-style bar that reminded Henry Clapp, the man who sort of the founder of the feast, the man who sat at the head of this table, it reminded him of the cafes that he'd encountered in Paris.
Okay, so let's start with Henry Clapp Jr., whom I guess was known as the King of Bohemia, but he wasn't. He was raised in a family of devout Congregationalists. How did he go from point A to point B?
Well, he grew up in New England, as you said, with a Congregationalist, a very strict Congregationalist background. He became a very esteemed lecturer during the 1840s on topics such as abolitionism, temperance. He often shared the stage with such luminaries as Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist firebrand. Well, in 1849, Clapp went to Paris to attend a three-day peace conference. And this was when Parisian-style bohemia was in full swing. The left bank was just exploding.
What was that like?
It was a really, Paris had a failed revolution the year before. And so it was a little like Vietnam War era America, the 1960s. You had You had in the cafes people, you know, talking revolution, talking, you know, throwing out slogans, and also just burning passionately for art. One of the things that kind of I found amusing about that original Parisian Bohemia was that one of its sort of conventions was a lot more talk of art than creation of art. So people in the cafes, you know, drinking coffee and whiskey and talking about their painting, their novel, whatever it might be, which might never get finished. But
the coffee and the whiskey were the draw.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
But Clapp was this influenced Clapp.
It influenced him greatly. He'd been a teetotaler to this point. He fell off the wagon. He fell into Parisian-style bohemia. He started hanging out in his cafes. He started drinking whiskey. He started chasing women. And when he returned to America, he decided not to return to New England of his strict Congregationalist upbringing, but rather than move to New York City, he started looking for a suitable venue to take this Parisian-style bohemia and kind of import it into America.
But when you think about Pfaffs, I mean, Paris is a city of cafes and sidewalks, and Pfaffs was kind of, it was underground, wasn't it?
It was. That was one of the interesting things about the saloon and made it yet harder to find it. You had to, you know, you had to sort of be committed. You wanted, it had to be suitable to you to find Pfaffs, because Pfaffs, it was subterranean, it was under the pavement, and you found it with a sign that was just dimly lettered on the wall that said Pfaffs, and then you opened up a hatchway in the Broadway sidewalk. It's almost like opening up the door to a root cellar. You descended down this steel metal staircase to the floor below, and then you had that space I was describing with one main big room and then that smaller vaulted room where Henry Clapp convened his group of bohemians.
All right, so he ends up at Pfaffs. And so, and he begins, he's like a magnet. Mm-hmm. These different people start to turn up at Pfaffs. Why? How are they drawn to him?
They're drawn by a couple different methods. One is, as I was describing earlier, you've got people just wandering along Broadway. They're just, that's their entertainment at a time when there were so fewer entertainments. And one example there is Walt Whitman. I mean, nobody knew the stretch of Broadway from, say, City Hall to Union Square better than Walt Whitman. So chances are, there's no record of exactly how he found his way to Pfaffs, but chances are he was just kind of wandering along. He was curious. Maybe someone told him there was this interesting saloon there. He opened up that hatchway, descended down, and he's like, these are my people. that was his story. Many other people, you know, Clapp, he was also a journalist by trade. And so besides being a lecturer, he started to lean more towards journalism. He knew a lot of people in New York journalistic circles, so he would also invite people to come into his circle.
We're going to get more to Walt Whitman in just a moment, but we have a question from Kevin. Can he explain what a bohemian was then? What's the definition of bohemian?
Sure. The definition of a bohemian, per the French model, is someone who's extremely unconventional, just almost has a pathological fear of convention, an intense passion for art. In the original Parisian model, often, as I described, more passion for art than actual creation of art. A hallmark is sexual openness. Hand in glove with the original bohemian lifestyle was substance abuse. And the great kind of almost cliche is that bohemians, that original crop of French bohemians, many of them died young, often under tragic circumstances, often due to tuberculosis. That was kind of the cliched way to die, brought on by living in a chilly, damp garret apartment. And so that was the model that Clapp adopted. And of course, there have always been bohemians. The whole history of the world have always been bohemians. But what Clapp's innovation was, he took this term, bohemian, and also took this very codified Parisian lifestyle, and he imported them to America. And so then people that joined him at Pfaffs, they very self-consciously modeled themselves. Those people that made the cut and sat at that long table, they very self-consciously modeled themselves after the Parisian model, and they described themselves as the Pfaffs Bohemians.
Uh-huh. So the man who came to be known as what, the good gray poet, mm-hmm. whom we associate with Camden, was a bohemian from New York originally?
He was a good example of someone who was a bohemian before the term existed, before he was familiar with the term. He was an impoverished poet at the time.
Walt Whitman.
Yeah, at the time he joined Clapp's circle at Pfaffs, he was actually living at home in a basement apartment in Brooklyn with his mother. He's 39 years old at the time, with his mother and a bunch of siblings crowded in together. He was a poet He was also unemployed as far as bringing in any income. So he was already a bohemian in deed, if not in name, before he joined the circle. And once he joined the circle, he called himself a bohemian. And Emerson, in fact, famously said of Whitman, he said he was all right until he became bohemian.
So, so he was largely unknown.
He was at that time. He'd had some small success coupled with some small level of criticism and even horror and contempt aimed at his first two editions of the poetry collection of Leaves of Grass, but he certainly was not a well-known figure at that point.
Did Pfaff shape his poetry?
Pfaff shaped his poetry just hugely. I mean, you're talking about an unemployed poet living at home. He spent almost every evening from 1858 to 1862 at Pfaff's, but that left him lots of time during the day to work. He wrote it was one of the most productive periods in his life, the time when he was at Pfaff's. He wrote over 100 new poems. Many of those poems dealt with bold new themes that he certainly was privy to at Pfaff's, such as romance between men. And then Henry Clapp, in turn. So what happened then was the landmark 1860 edition of Leaves of Grass, vastly expanded from the earlier two editions with these more than 100 new poems. That was really heavily influenced by Whitman's time at Pfaff's. And then it, too, initially at least, started to sink like a stone. It wasn't making much of an impression. It was getting only a handful of reviews, and most of them were very negative. But then Henry Clapp, the King of Bohemia, stepped to Whitman's aid. He actually, in his Saturday Press, a journal that Clapp founded, he commissioned three separate reviews of Leaves of Grass. He arranged for the bohemians that sat at that long table to write appreciations of Whitman, to write essays about him, bits of gossip, and parodies of his poetry. All this gave the impression that Whitman was being buzzed about, widely discussed. And Clapp's journal... Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was listening. I was just thinking of this this review, because you're talking about this positive effort from Clapp. But as you write in the book, Leaves of Grass was reviewed by the Boston Intelligencer. And I love this quote. There is neither wit nor method in his disjointed babbling. And it seems to us he must be some escaped lunatic raving in pitiable delirium.
Those are the kind
strong stuff.
Yeah, those are the kind of when Whitman got reviews, and maybe the worst thing was he got so very few reviews for his first two, and even initially for the third edition of Leaves of Grass, that was the kind of review he tended to get, full of derision, horror, disgust. So Clapp turned around and, as I said, commissioned reviews, essays, appreciations. His publication, The Saturday Press, for its brief, penniless life, was so influential that actually often articles that appeared first in The Saturday Press would get picked up by as many as 200, I found in my research, as many as 200 publications around the country, in San Francisco, Denver, Houston, you name it. So this all gave the impression that Whitman was being buzzed about, that there were positive attributes to Leaves of Grass. The net effect was that third edition, that was, you might call that the Pfaff's edition of Leaves of Grass, it started to sell, it started to get more attention, get reviews other places, and it began to take off.
More on Whitman in just a moment. Our guest is Justin Martin, author of Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman and America's First Bohemians. As always, we enjoy hearing from you. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Back in just a moment.
PNC Arts Alive and Opera Philadelphia support WHYY and present Opera on the Mall, The Barber of Seville, Saturday, September 27th, an HD broadcast at Independence Mall, open to the public. Tickets at operaonthemall.org.
Guided by Quaker values, Folkways at Gwinnett, a continuing care retirement community for active adults 65 and over since 1967, supports WHYY. Folkways provides residents with proven financial stability, a comprehensive health care program, and a community where friendship, caring, dignity, and respect are a way of life. One- and two-bedroom apartments, highlighting Folkways' newest design features, are now available. To experience life at Folkways and to arrange a personal tour, 215-283-7010.
Hi, I'm filmmaker Ken Burns. You choose WHYY because you appreciate the shows it delivers every day, because it offers something different. WHYY provides trustworthy news coverage offers a gateway to the arts and educates viewers and listeners of all ages with support from individuals like you. Visit WHYY.org or call 888-345-9499. And as always, thank you.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first ever Lincoln MKC with the all-new available 2.3-liter EcoBoost powertrain for the power and poise to handle any driving situation. More available at Lincoln.com.
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. This is Radio Times, and our guest this hour offers a fascinating look into early bohemianism in this country. Justin Martin is author of Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman, and America's First Bohemians. And the telephone number to call if you'd like to jump in, if you have a question or a comment, is 1-888-477-9499. Our email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at @WHYY Radio Times. So back to Walt Whitman. You mentioned earlier in the show that he was gay. This was known among the crowd at FAFS, and that was accepted.
It was. FAFS was a really welcoming atmosphere. Of course, this was an era before terminology even existed. You know, gay meant lighthearted. The term homosexual wouldn't have come into wide usage until the 1880s, really. But FAFS was a sort of, you might call it, an open, welcoming environment. Certainly part of the time Whitman was sitting at that long table with Clapp and many other artists, some of whom were gay. And then much of the rest of the time he was in FAFS' larger room that was just full of, you might call them, all different kinds of bohemian odds and ends, including plenty of gay men. He met a lot of men there. And at least in this kind of safe, open-minded world, Whitman was you know, not particularly judged or derided.
Was he able to find one love with whom to settle down?
He had a couple loves during his life and one great love, a man named Peter Doyle. But you couldn't really say that Whitman ever quite settled down. I mean, he and Peter Doyle had a very, very serious relationship. They never lived together. In fact, that ultimately was one of the tensions between them, maybe even hastened their ultimate breakup, was the fact that I think Whitman was older than Peter Doyle. He wanted more out of the relationship. He wanted more commitment. So kind of a classic story. So you could say Peter Doyle was the great love of his life. He had several other loves. He never managed to settle down, though, as far as he never had a relationship that really, you know, just was for many years living together and so forth.
Okay. We'll talk a little bit more about where Whitman went after he left FAFS. But right now I'd like to get back into the crowd. FAFS welcomed women, too, which was unusual for the time.
It was really unusual for the time. This was a time of real gender segregation in American society. In fact, there's a saloon that people might be familiar with in New York City that dates to about the same time FAFS was founded. It started in 1854, McSorley's. And McSorley's original slogan was, "Good food, good ale, no women." So the fact...
Lovely.
Yeah, very nice. The fact that FAFS was welcoming the women says a lot about the proprietor, Charles Ignatius Pfaff, who hailed from Germany. It also says a lot about Clapp, that he had women as regulars at his long table, quite a few of them. And Clapp, interestingly enough, one of the many topics he lectured on in his early days when he grew up in New England was women's suffrage. In the 1840s, he was an advocate for women's suffrage. That was, 80 years before the 19th Amendment. So it says a lot about Clapp, and it says a lot about FAFS, that it was a place that welcomed women and took them seriously as artists.
Tell us about Ada Clare. Who you dubbed the Queen of Bohemia?
Yeah, Ada Clare was dubbed actually the Queen of Bohemia by the circle. You had the King of Bohemia, who was Henry Clapp, and you had Ada Clare, who was the Queen, and she was...
What did she look like, and what did she do when she was at FAFS?
She was a small kind of pixie-ish looking woman, and she had a little upturned nose, and her hair was kind of cut short, which was kind of unusual in that era.
Sure.
But it kind of communicated a seriousness to her that and in her case, she was just an incredibly trenchant essayist, and she was way, way ahead of her time. You might call her a proto-feminist. I mean, she wrote essays on topics like how the fashions of the day, things like hoop skirts, that they had an element of sadomasochism, that they were designed to slow women down and make them servile. She wrote essays, really cutting-edge essays, about sexual double standards, about the fact that that women are encouraged to be chaste, which is kind of a passive attribute, while men are brave, which is a kind of active attribute. So very clever essayist. One of the things that I loved in doing my research was her essays really held up. I mean, a lot of times things from 150 years ago are no longer funny or no longer trenchant or whatever it might be.
Sure.
In her case, rereading a lot of these old essays, I found they really, they hit their mark.
And then on the flip side, you had Ada Menken.
That's right. Ada Menken, who was a dear friend of Ada Clare. Ada Menken she was an actress. She was part of this circle. And she gained incredible notoriety for a role, just a crazy role, in a play called Mazeppa, in which she played the lead role. Mazeppa was a Tartar warrior, and she played this lead role in drag. And in the climactic scene, Mazeppa's enemies tear off his tunic. That revealed Ada Isaacs Menken, the buxom actress, underneath, and she was wearing a sheer flesh-colored body stocking,
which was probably shocking at the time.
It was shocking, and in the flickering, in those days, you had these flickering calcium lights that provided the illumination of theater.
Uh-huh.
In that sheer body stocking, you couldn't tell whether she was naked or not. So people were already gripped. But then the next part was, once she's stripped down to the sheer flesh-colored body stocking, she was then strapped on her back, spread eagle, to a real-life horse that proceeded to climb a four-story-high prop that was meant to look like a mountain.
And that sounds painful.
Yeah, yeah, I think she actually had some experience from growing up as a bareback rider in the circus, and so she was very well suited for this role because she could handle being strapped to a real live horse, and she had lashings that she could kind of pull on to keep herself on the horse as it went up this platform and control it a bit. And it was, as I said, it was a hit,
well,
big hit.
You write she wasn't a very good actress, and yet this Mazeppa, is mm-hmm. that was the name. It was a hit across the country and across the world because she was a provocateur.
It was a huge hit. I mean, she had a bunch of things working for her. Yeah, she was a terrible actress. She'd forget her lines. The play, in any case, I mean, the play is essentially about Balkan geopolitics with some, with a little bit of swordplay and some long, tiresome speeches that she'd forget about, diplomatic intrigues. But the thing she had working for her was some skill riding horses, based on her growing up and being a bareback rider, a real fearlessness, and also just a incredible, I described in this book as a drop-dead sexiness that projected all the way into the cheap seats. I mean, she was a very good-looking woman, and so the combination of her fearlessness, skill on horses, and being really good-looking made her an international sensation.
I'm wondering if modern-day entertainers like Lady Gaga owe her a debt.
I think they likely do. I mean, a lot of the people in the Pfaff circle, certainly influence modern day bohemians, people like Lady Gaga or Lena Dunham. And, people today may not remember the names of some of these people like Ada Isaacs Menken, but their animating spirit lives on.
The Pfaff's crew, you say, idolized Edgar Allan Poe. Why was that? Because he never turned up at Pfaff's.
He didn't turn up at Pfaff's. He died in 1849, I believe, which was about
before.
A decade. Yeah, really, yeah. About a decade before the Pfaff scene was in full flower. But he was kind of, although he was not called a bohemian during his lifetime, he was certainly a quintessential bohemian, impoverished, substance abuse problems, just burning, alive for art, and insane. So all of those things contributed to making him an early bohemian.
So if they idolized him, did they read his work while they were there, or they discussed him, they pick him apart? What did they do?
A couple ways they idolized him were several people. One of the members of the circle was a guy named Fitz James O'Brien, and he was a writer who kind of emulated Poe. He wrote these kind of macabre short stories, and he's sometimes called the Celtic Poe, for those that remember him, Fitz James O'Brien. The other way that they emulated Poe was Poe gave people license to explore dark themes in their art, which many of these bohemians did. He certainly made substance abuse glamorous in a 19th century way, and also Poe reputedly would draw on the walls of his rented rooms in charcoal, you know, these sort of mad sketches. There's no proof that this is true, but this is what was believed, and what was believed by the fast Bohemian. So many of these impoverished young artists would also, in a Poe-like style, draw, you know, wild, mad sketches on the walls of their little garret rooms.
Our guest is Justin Martin, author of Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman and America's First Bohemians. And the telephone lines are open, 1-888-477-9499, our email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at @whyyradiotimes. So FAFS is really getting rolling just before the Civil War gets underway. And of course, the war brought forth carnage unlike any that this country had seen. Let's get back to Walt Whitman, because this marks the time, I guess, at which he left FAFS, and his brother George was fighting in the war, and he decides to head to Washington.
That's correct. Yeah, he heads down the what happens is the Civil War, you know, just really disrupts and dismantles the FAFS scene. The various artists fan out across the country, and some of them are called into service in the war. But these are the term didn't exist, but these are kind of peaceniks. These are mostly kind of peaceable people. So very few of them actually join the war effort, but a lot of them either take their shows on the road to entertain, you know, people on the home front, or in the case of Whitman, he had a Quaker upbringing. He was a peaceable person. He did not want to be involved in the war effort as a soldier, but he found his place in the war very, very much. He went down to Washington, and he ministered to wounded soldiers in the hospitals in and around Washington. And so that was really a role that, you know, with this grand, huge carnage, tumultuous event, this was a way that Whitman could find his place in that by ministering to the wounded soldiers.
He spent many hours doing this. How did this shape his poetry, if at all?
It shaped his poetry in just amazing ways. He wrote a whole series of Civil War poems about his experience tending to the wounded soldiers, and it's some of his best and most powerful poetry. He planned to bring it out as a separate volume, the first volume outside of the Leaves of Grass franchise, as you might call it, called Drum Taps. And just before Drum Taps was to be self-published, at the tail end of the Civil War, President Lincoln was assassinated. Mm. Whitman immediately realized that a collection of poetry about tending to Civil War soldiers that didn't include this event, Lincoln's assassination, was going to be immediately kind of obsolete and irrelevant. So he withdrew it from self-publication, added a series of new poems, including "O Captain, My Captain," maybe his best-known poem. Then he published Drum Taps to very little acclaim, but then he ultimately integrated the best of those poems, like "O Captain, My Captain," into subsequent editions of Leaves of Grass, and so those poems, those powerful Civil War poems, became part of the whole big ball of wax that was Leaves of Grass.
He admired Lincoln.
He admired Lincoln, and one of the things I loved learning about in my research was he saw Lincoln while Whitman was down tending to the wounded soldiers in Washington. He saw Lincoln almost every single day. This was just it was such a different era.
I was just going to say, I wanted to jump on that because he saw the president out and about, and it was so different.
So different. It made me think, actually, this past weekend, I believe it was, somebody jumped the gate of the White House, and that was international news that someone got onto the grounds of the White House. Well, in Whitman's day, you would see Lincoln just walking. I mean, Whitman would be headed to a hospital. Lincoln would walk by at a rapid clip, you know, maybe an advisor beside him, telling him, giving him some ideas about what was going on in the Civil War, what happened. Whitman saw Lincoln so often that he'd write letters to his mother or to friends in which he'd say, you know, today Lincoln looked more careworn than usual. Today he looked more lighthearted than when I saw him yesterday. And the thing I particularly found kind of heartrending and touching was Whitman saw Lincoln every day, often at close range, just walking by him in the street, and Whitman just observed him minutely, and yet there's no record that Whitman ever said a word to Lincoln. It was just somebody that this awesome presence, this symbol of union that Whitman saw on a daily basis, but did not speak to at any point.
He admired Lincoln, and yet I love this description that you write of Whitman's in reference to Lincoln. He has a face like a Hoosier Michelangelo, so awful ugly it becomes beautiful with its strange mouth, its deep cut crisscross lines, and its donut complexion.
I thought that, isn't that a wonderful description that Whitman came up with? I love it because we have those strange, I mean, those Matthew Brady photographs where Lincoln is one of the strangest looking human beings ever to walk the earth, as far as I'm concerned. And it's great that one of the greatest writers ever has a description. It pairs very nicely. If you look at a Whitman portrait, or rather, if you look at a Lincoln portrait, and then you read that description, it's a nice pairing.
Before we get to the phones, is it likely Lincoln read Leaves of Grass?
It's very likely that he read it because, of all things, Lincoln's law partner in Springfield, it is known that he owned a second edition of Leaves of Grass. And Lincoln was a rare president who is really just passionate about the arts. It's very likely that he read the collection of poetry. However, he never made any kind of comment about it. That in and of itself doesn't really disqualify that he read it because he was a presidential candidate and later a president. Leaves of Grass was not the kind of artwork you necessarily wanted to associate yourself with. So the fact
sure.
that
it was considered to be salacious at the time.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and Lincoln liked that kind of thing, by the way, but he wouldn't have necessarily, he was canny enough, he wouldn't have necessarily let someone know that he'd read this salacious collection of poetry, but it's very likely he read it.
Gotcha. Okay. Natalie in Ocean City, New Jersey, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
So my question for the author is, having spent a lot of time in Europe myself, what is the biggest difference between America Bohemia and European via Bohemia?
Interesting question. Thanks, Natalie.
Well, I guess circa those early days, there wasn't really, I guess the main difference was Parisian society was so much more well-suited for Bohemia that it was possible to have a sort of a larger and more above ground Bohemia, you might describe it. American society, at least in the 1850s, it's no surprise you had an underground saloon on Broadway. It was a much more sort of in the shadows movement that was existing in contrast to a more, you might say, a more conservative society. That's the difference I would cite.
All right. Thanks for the call, Natalie, to Radio Times. Let's talk quickly before we head to our break about the ties to Mark Twain. He never ended up at FAFS, and yet he was known at FAFS.
He sure was. Well, here's the connection. Artemus Ward, who sat at that long table.
He was the comic.
He was the comic. Okay. That's right. I described earlier how people fanned out at the beginning of the Civil War and actually, in some cases, found a measure of success. In Artemus Ward's case, he was entertaining people on the home front during the Civil War, and he made his way out to raucous Silver Rush, Nevada. And there in Virginia City, he made fast friends with a young comic writer who only a few months earlier had adopted the pen name Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, next thing that happens, quite incredible, quite amazing. Artemus Ward says to Mark Twain, who really doesn't have anything more than a regional reputation here out west, says, "Why don't you send me some of your stuff?" The kind of thing that someone would say to a young aspiring writer. Well, Mark Twain followed up with that. He sent a story to Artemus Ward that Artemus Ward ultimately passed along to Henry Clapp, who, as I mentioned, published this journal, the Saturday Press, which was very influential, sometimes reached as many, got reprinted as many as 200 places around the country. That story was The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. It appeared first in Henry Clapp, the King of Bohemia's journal, and it really set the stage for Twain's national reputation.
It all seems to go back to FAFS, doesn't it?
It all comes back to FAFS.
Dustin Martin is author of Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman, and America's First Bohemians. The number is 888-477-9499. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're going to take a short break and then more on the Bohemian movement in America and FAFS. Stay with us.
Forever Young supports WHYY. Forever Young, bringing happiness to life, is a health and wellness event featuring positive psychology author Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar, plus leading experts and instructors. Forever Young offers 30 lectures and fitness classes to help you live a healthier, happier life. Forever Young takes place Sunday, November 9th at the Philadelphia Marriott. Doors open at 9 a.m. More information and general admission and luncheon tickets at foreveryounghealth.org.
The promise of genetically modified crops.
How do we double the amount of food between now and 2050?
But activist Vandana Shiva says Monsanto Corporation is destroying the third world.
It's based on stealing the biological heritage of the third world.
Searching for the truth about GMOs next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
International House Philadelphia supports WHYY. Events coming soon to International House. Herzog's Nosferatu on October 4th. Jordanian virtuoso Farah Siraj in concert on October 10th. A celebration of Diwali, the Festival of Lights, on October 23rd. And in conjunction with the Philadelphia Museum of Art's exhibit, Paul Strand, Master of Modern Photography, the Paul Strand film series begins on October 24th with a screening of his first feature-length film, Radies. Tickets and info at ihousephilly.org. International House Philadelphia, the hub of international culture.
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times, and our guest this hour is Justin Martin, author of Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman, and America's First Bohemians. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number. It's 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email if you'd like, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet works just as well, at WHYY Radio Times. So Justin, let's get to the Booth Brothers and their association, however peripheral, with FAFS.
Yeah, their association is Edwin Booth knew a lot of the main figures at FAFS.
He was an actor.
He was an actor and part of a kind of an acting dynasty. His father, Junius, was known as the Mad Tragedian, was one of the great actors of the first part of the 19th century. And Edwin and a couple of his brothers followed in their father's footsteps. And Edwin was very much part of this circle from the standpoint that Henry Clapp constantly wrote. He, besides filling his journal with news and reviews of Whitman, the other person he spent a lot of time on is Edwin Booth, just essays, reviews, kind of worrying about his artistic choices. Was his newest Hamlet as good as his previous one? Was he fulfilling his artistic destiny? Booth was also really close friends with a bunch of members of this circle, including a guy named Fitzhugh Ludlow, who wrote The Hashish Eater, one of the best-selling books of 1857. He and Edwin Booth were very close friends. But Edwin Booth, terrible alcoholic. He belonged at FAFS, but it appears that he liked to drink alone. So he was part of the circle from sort of being friends with a lot of them, from being very much a sort of an artist of that era. But as for his drinking, he didn't appear to show up at saloons, including FAFS. He appears to have gone back to his apartment.
Okay, but his brother was also an actor.
That's right. His brother was also an actor.
John Wilkes.
That's right. John Wilkes, where Edwin was you know, a very talented, ultimately very disciplined actor. Brother John Wilkes was a strange, slovenly, undisciplined actor. Strikingly handsome, that kind of got him by, but not especially gifted as an actor.
And he was obsessed with the South.
The Booth brothers had grown up in Maryland, which was a border state, mm-hmm. and so people went both ways as far as their allegiances go. Almost the entire Booth family, certainly Edwin, the father, Junius, they were all abolitionists, certainly with the Union cause. John Wilkes had spent some time at a boarding school where he'd met some children of the aristocracy, the Southern aristocracy, sons of this aristocracy, and he became very enamored of the ideas of Southern aristocracy and the institution of slavery. So he divided from the family as far as that said. During the Civil War, being an actor was kind of a passport to move between the North and the South. Nobody took actors seriously, so if your allegiance was to the North or to the South, no one was all that concerned. Because of the better paydays, the better roads, the more robust theater attendance in the North, Southern sympathizing John Wilkes Booth spent almost the entire Civil War traveling to Providence, Hartford, Boston, so on and so forth, and playing his various roles.
You write that President Lincoln had seen John Wilkes Booth in a play, but preferred his brother Edwin as an actor.
That's right. He went to see Edwin in a play called Richelieu, and Lincoln liked Richelieu so much he returned six times. He only saw John Wilkes once, and according to the reviews, John Wilkes Booth just really kind of dragged through that particular performance, and Lincoln would not see him again until the fateful night.
Yeah, so let's get to that story. The Civil War is nearing its end. And 6 days after the close of the war is when the president is assassinated. John Wilkes Booth had mail privileges at Ford's Theater, and he knew that building well.
Mm-hmm. That is right. Now, he actually, it's just crazy how this all came together. He went to pick up his mail on that fateful Friday morning in April, and he learned that Lincoln was going to be there then. Now, he'd spent the entire spring of 1865 catching kind of harebrained schemes for maybe kidnapping Lincoln, maybe killing him. Suddenly, he had an idea. He could go to Ford's Theater that night. He shows up at Ford's Theater, and he knows the theater. He knows its layout. He has to get through two unlocked doors. That's all he has to do. The single Washington, D.C. police officer who'd been assigned to guard Lincoln, different era, Lincoln that night, has gone next door to a bar to drink. So those two unlocked doors are completely unattended. Not only did he know the Ford Theater, he also knew the play that was being performed that night called Our American Cousin. And he knew when a big laugh line was coming up, when the audience would burst into laughter. He waited for that. He waited in front of the second door, waited for that laugh line, opened that door at that point, leveled his single-shot Derringer, and shot and assassinated Lincoln. One of the things that kind of ties this all together with Fafs is Peter Doyle. We talked earlier about Whitman's various love interests.
Yes.
Well, Peter Doyle, of all things, was present at Ford's Theater that night, and he saw the aftermath. You know, he heard the shot. He saw Booth jump out of the box where Lincoln had been down onto the stage, saw him run off the stage. He later shared his firsthand account of Lincoln's assassination with his lover, Walt Whitman, and Whitman drew on that firsthand account to create this magical, transcendent poetry that Whitman wrote about Lincoln and Lincoln's assassination.
Fascinating. Well, that actually ties into our next telephone call. Let's go to Florence from Westchester. Hello, Florence.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, welcome to Radio Times.
Okay.
What's your comment?
I have two, and I'd like to say them both so one doesn't get lost before he answers. The first is, I love Whitman, studied him in graduate school way back when. I'm doing a lot of research on him now because I'm teaching a course at our Adult Lifelong Learning Institute. Nowhere in any of the biographies have I read outright definitively that he was gay. I know Peter Doyle he's mentioned, but I've always, from the biographies, gotten the impression that the jury was out. So that's one question, where his sources to say he's definitely gay. The other is in Drum Taps, he mentions Oh Captain, My Captain, including that, and that was indeed his very popular poem, the only poem anthologized during his life. But what hasn't been mentioned is When Lilacs Lasted, The Dooryard Bloomed, which is an absolutely exquisite exquisite eulogy, and really considered one of his best poems. So those are kind of two comments, if he can kind of respond to them.
Sure. Thank you, Florence.
Sure. I'll take them in reverse order. Thanks for mentioning When Lilacs Last in the Barnyard Bloom, which is just, as you said, a lovely, beautiful elegy to the slain president. As for Whitman being gay, it's just manifestly obvious. I mean, he was intensely attracted to men. He lived with a man in Brooklyn. He had a passionate relationship with Peter Doyle, in which he said, you know, my love for you is immeasurable.
So are these things that are written down?
These are things that are written down, absolutely. He wrote his poetry. Anybody who reads Whitman closely will see that he has a very electric, interest and attachment to men he describes in his poetry, where it's much more distant with women. But the thing that I would most urge to anybody who's curious about this is it's no surprise that a poet, an impoverished poet, would be gay in the 19th century. And further, I think people have the wrong standard for gay because, of course, no one can follow him into the bedroom and know what happened. However, that's the wrong standard. The standard for being gay should be you're romantically attracted to someone of the same sex.
So these are the conclusions that you drew investigations that you did in researching this book.
Absolutely.
How did Whitman come to live in Camden?
He came to live in Camden because he'd had a stroke, and then his mother was being cared for by his brother George in Camden. And he learned not long, just a few months after he'd had his stroke, that his mother was dying. He rushed to her bedside at George's house in Camden, and his mother died just a few days after he arrived. But he was still suffering the ill effects from the stroke. He also was in a period of kind of decline of his relationship with Peter Doyle, who was in Washington, where he'd been living. And so he decided to stay. He took a leave of absence from his job. Then he took another leave of absence. Then he finally just decided to settle in to Camden. And he fell in love with Camden because it reminded him of the Brooklyn of his earlier days, because it kind of, by analogy, Brooklyn you cross the river to Manhattan, Camden you cross the river to Philadelphia. So he liked that kind of analogy.
Let's get back into your research. You're a journalist who's done biographies of Alan Greenspan, Ralph Nader. Where did you even begin to look to find some of the information about this relatively obscure place, Pfaff's, of a century and a half ago?
Well, the great thing was, because a lot of these people were celebrities of their day, Artemus Ward, the comedian, Ada Isaacs Minkin, the naked lady, as she was sometimes called, there was a lot of stuff just readily available. There were newspaper articles, books about these folks that were written in the time. So that was findable. People hadn't been consulting these particular newspaper articles or sources or what have you, but it was out there. It wasn't like a person who lived their life in obscurity 150 years ago without accounting, in this case. And then, of course, some of these people, they did write letters and other realia that have been saved in various archives. Like, say, Union College has an archive devoted to their graduate, Fitzhugh Ludlow, the author of The Hashish Eater. I'm not sure anybody had consulted the archive in a while, but nevertheless, it was there with letters that his sister had written about his drug use and so forth. But I should also mention, it's no surprise that this book was written in 2014, not 1974 or 1934. The internet made a lot of connections. Just being able to put in a name like Fitz James O'Brien or Fitzhugh Ludlow turned up connections, archives, sources that somebody would have had to do a lot more laborious footwork and might not have even been able to find certain things in a different era, in a different pre-Google era.
Okay, what are some of your thoughts on why so many of these people who frequented Pfaff's Bohemians, why did they end up, we know they died young, but why were they so unhappy at points? I mean, you write that Ada Menken regularly signed her letters, I'm pronouncing this Latin correctly, in Felix. Is that correct?
Sounds good to me.
It's a dead language, so who knows, but it's Latin for
the unhappy. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they seem to be at the top of their game and really living life in the moment. And then on the flip side, they were miserable.
I think that this first group of American Bohemians, this first sort of self-styled group of American Bohemians, I think that they were real, true artists. They burn for art, and hand in glove with that goes unhappiness, I guess, is the way to put it. I mean, these were people that, though they found success in the case of Artemus Ward or in the case of Ada Isaacs Minkin, just their artistic personalities guaranteed that worldly success couldn't fill them up, And I always think, I particularly think, I'll give you what I think is sort of a great analogy here, a great modern analogy. When I learned that Robin Williams had killed himself, it really reminded me of the personality of Artemus Ward. Artemus Ward was a classic comedian. He was a sad clown. He was giving the world levity and laughter, and inside it all, he was darkness and melancholy. And so, Robin Williams, I guess, is a good example of someone who had everything to the outside observer, and yet chose to end his life. And these people were the same kind of, you know, sort of pure, passionate artist.
The last Bohemian wave, correct me if I'm wrong, was in Greenwich Village in the 1960s.
Yeah, that's a although, you know, they're still, you know, Bohemians to this day and, you know, everywhere.
but I mean, I'm wondering if there's room in our culture today for another wave, because it seems to be so entrenched in our society.
I kind of suspect there will be, particularly because the original Bohemia, part of what drove it is you had a lot of people showing up in Paris. Then later you had a lot of people showing up in New York. They're drawn to cities. They want to create art, but the economy is never robust enough to support as many artists as there are people that are applicants to that position. And so the net effect of that is you have a lot of frustrated, alienated people who have an artistic sensibility and want to create art and hope to achieve some kind of acclaim or what have you. That's fertile ground for Bohemians. And of course, we have a rough economy now. We have way, way more people desiring to create art. And we, of course, have massive literacy rates, you know, almost, you know, so a lot of people can write, a lot of people can play music, a lot of people can create art. There's not such a market for it. I think conditions are ripe for some kind of. Of course, there are pockets of Bohemian, Austin, Texas, or Asheville, North Carolina, what have you. But I think conditions are ripe, maybe for another Bohemian movement akin to the '60s in Greenwich Village.
Speaking of art, if you would take La Boheme and talk about how that production is relevant today.
Sure. Well, La Boheme grows out of in 1849, when Henry Clapp, the King of Bohemia, first visited Paris. Another thing besides the failed revolution that was really driving this Bohemian fever was a work of art, a play called La Vita Boheme. In the 1890s, Puccini adapted that play into the opera that we all know, La Boheme. Then La Boheme, of course, was the basis for Rent. They just took it and transported the idea of these Bohemians, and the early death that would have been by tuberculosis in La Boheme was, of course, AIDS in the 80s in the East Village of New York City. But that's really Jonathan Larson, the creator of Rent, was taking La Boheme and adapting it to what was then the modern America. And it's an enduring, you know, Rent, of course, brought an enduring concept of La Vie de Bohème to a whole new group of people.
To the modern stage.
To the modern stage, huh?
Justin Martin, it was a pleasure. Very entertaining.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Justin Martin has written Rebel Souls, Walt Whitman, and America's First Bohemians. And this reminder, you can find out more about our program, including our Facebook page and podcasts, by visiting whyy.org/radio times. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. And Quinn Lipson is our intern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thank you so much for joining us.